First, we shall sing one traditional song, which is a window into the spiritual world. Jai Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari. Jai Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari. Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivardhari. Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivardhari. Yashoda Nandana Vajjana Ranjana. Yashoda Nandana Vajjana Ranjana. Yashoda Nandana Vajjana Ranjana. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Jai Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari. Jai Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari. Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivardhari. Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivardhari. Yashoda Nandana Vrajajana Ranjana. Yashoda Nandana Vrajajana Ranjana. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Shall I read from the Lila Amrit?
Absolutely.
But it has one dangerous feature. One gets absorbed and doesn't want to stop.
Indeed.
And hours go by and then everyone is saying, we want to go to breakfast.
We'll do the best we can.
That's the problem with Bhakti Yoga. It has an enchanting effect. One gets lost. Bombay, November 1971. For a year, the devotees had been living at the Akash Ganga address, two apartments on the seventh floor of a building in the heart of Bombay. But Prabhupada was not satisfied with this. He wanted land in Bombay to build on and to expand. He was determined. A neophyte devotee thinks he's already doing a lot for Krishna, and when he gets in a comfortable situation, he just wants to enjoy that situation. That's the lakshana, or characteristic, of a neophyte devotee. A very advanced devotee, what to speak of a Shaktivesh avatar and Nitya Siddha, associate of the Lord, confidential parishad, when he begins the service, he thinks, how can it be done to the highest extent? And he's never satisfied. He wants everything to be done more and more for Krishna's pleasure. And that's a symptom of the spiritual world. That's a sharp demarcation between the material and the spiritual. In the spiritual, everyone is very ambitious about increasing their service to Krishna. They never think they're doing enough. Mother Yashoda, she's always thinking, what more can I do? She stays up all night selecting which kinds of pearl necklaces and garlands, and she goes to special rivers and collects scented water she's going to use for bathing Krishna the next day. It's not good enough. She has to find something better always. That's not good enough. How can anything be good enough for Krishna? That's the psychology. See, we have to know about it because we're training. We're like in training. We're prospective candidates for pure devotional service. That's what it means, actually, Prabhupada's movement. So we have to learn the psychology. We have to study in great detail the psychology of a very exalted Vaishnava, which are so rare. They don't come to this world generally. Extremely rare appearance in this material world. We're so blessed because our whole line happens to be these kind of persons. Our whole lineage, disciplic succession, consists of these supermen of spirituality. We're just like little ducklings trying to follow, running behind these great swan-like personalities. But it's okay. They're merciful. If you just follow their program, gradually we get caught up in the mood. Prabhupada was not satisfied with this. He wanted land in Bombay to build on, to expand. He was determined. Instead of his usual morning walks, he would take long rides in his car to observe various parts of the city. Like a general mapping out which territories he wants to conquer. No, that's, and Prabhupada would say like that many times. Military analogies Prabhupada would give constantly in his lectures. Because it gets you in shape, it gets you fired up, and no laziness. No lazies, no crazies, Prabhupada. It burns away your anartas. See, the anartas linger on in your consciousness if you're not working intensely. Then the anartas stay decade after decade. They can hang, or lifetime they'll hang around. Because you still want them. Krishna just reciprocates. You still want the anartas. You're not fired up to get rid of them. But a serious Madhyama Adhikari, he wants to get rid of his anartas. The Kanishthas just want to find a comfortable spot somewhere in devotional service. And the Uttamas, they're wild after pleasing Krishna. And it doesn't matter what difficulties they have to undergo. So let's at least, this movement is for Madhyama Adhikaris, Prabhupada said. We should try to be Madhyama Bhaktas at least.
What's an anartha? What does it mean? What is it?
Artha means that which has value, and anartha negates that which has. It's actually worse than having no value. It's something that positively detains you or holds you back. It's a material desire to enjoy the material energy, or desire to imitate Krishna that stays in your consciousness because we've had it for millions of lifetimes, we've cultivated. If we wonder why our mind is such a monster, because we hand fed it and built it up. It's like we've created a monster. It's not like a giant green monster in the temple. Imagine a green monster 12 feet tall touching the ceiling. It's huge. All the false pride, we want people to honor us and notice us. We become very angry if someone insults us. That's an anartha. We want lots of sense gratification, bodily and mental sense gratification, because we're addicted to these things. But if you're serious about devotional service, These anarthas actually go away very quickly. They go away according to how fast they go away is according to how intensely you are trying to serve Krishna. When you really get into some service for Krishna, these anarthas, they just go away. One time devotees asked Prabhupada, why is it so difficult? Why is Maya so strong? Prabhupada says, because your determination is so weak. If you're very determined, like Dhruva Maharaj, the classic example the Prabhupada always gives, he achieved perfection in 6 months, and he started with the wrong motive. It's not that he didn't have material desires. He had huge material desires, probably greater than ours. He wasn't satisfied with just having a house and a couple cars. He wanted the whole universe. He wanted a kingdom greater than his father's kingdom. So having material desires is not a fundamental disqualification. But what is a disqualification is if we don't engage intensely in devotional service. That slows you down very seriously, not engaging intensely. Even if you want something material, okay, maybe the idea of purification is unpalatable in and of itself. You like the way you are psychologically, but okay, then work intensely for Krishna. And what happens is you cannot lose. Either Krishna satisfies your material desires, which is what you want anyway, or Krishna will take them away in such a way you'll be so happy when they're gone. Really, this is a mystical thing. Maybe we don't understand at this point. But I tell you, each time a giant anartha goes away, you feel so relieved. You feel so ecstatic. Actually, the real ecstasy of devotional service comes when, to the extent that our anarthas are dissolved away. So the far-out thing about devotional service, you cannot actually lose. You cannot lose if you're intense. If you're not intense, you still don't lose, but it just takes a long, long time. It takes many lifetimes. You're just sort of hanging around. Actually, then, because you're not getting enough taste, then you begin to consider leaving the Hare Krishna movement, looking for taste outside. That's what happens. That's the effect of weak, of wishy-washy devotional service. Instead of his usual morning walks, he would take long rides in his car to observe various parts of the city. Because many of the ISKCON life members lived in aristocratic Malabar Hill, Prabhupada's disciples thought it a good place for a temple. On several occasions, Prabhupada rode to the top of Malabar Hill and walked around various properties. I don't know Bombay very well. I guess none of us are. Prabhupada rode to the top of Malabar Hill and walked around various properties, considering certain large buildings as possible temples, but for one reason or another, he judged them all unacceptable. Then in November, a Mr. N offered to sell ISKCON 5 acres in Juhu, practically on the shore of the Arabian Sea. As soon as Srila Prabhupada approached the land, he remembered having seen it and considered it years before. In August 65, during the weeks just before he had left for America, he had stayed at the Scindia colony. Scindia is the steamship company that gave Prabhupada a free ride, Mrs. Morarji. There'll be a test tomorrow. These are all wonderful landmark historical names and places and events in ISKCON history. If Prabhupada didn't do these things, we would be doing some bogus yoga something or whatever horrible other material thing. So these are like national monuments, like they have a monument of Washington there, and we would have big monuments. These are all wonderful things, actually. In the evenings, he had gone to the home of Scindia Steamship Company owner Mrs. Sumati Morarji in Juhu, where he had read and explained Srimad Bhagavatam for her and her guests. She was a very pious lady. She recognized a sadhu when she saw him, and they gave him free passage to America.
You said she was the owner of the company?
Yeah. She was very wealthy, actually. Yeah, she was the owner. She owned the whole company. She was very rich and very devoted. Very devoted to Lord Krishna. In the Miami temple, the temple room itself is literally 8 times bigger than this. Have you ever been there? It's completely huge, and it's all marble. She paid for all the marble for that temple. It's like amazing. It's almost as big. Actually, yeah, it's almost as big as the Brooklyn Temple. It's really huge. I'm surprised. Way out in the middle of nowhere. She paid for all the marble, and that's like $10,000. Just because she visited there one time, and she's really... Several times, Prabhupada had passed this very property and thought it was a good location for an ashram and Radha Krishna temple. Although his attention had been absorbed in the task of leaving India, he had still considered the Juhu land. Now he was again in Juhu, reconsidering the same land he had noticed before. He took this as a reminder from Krishna. Now Prabhupada was coming back triumphant and victorious with 40 dancing white elephants he had recruited from Maya's kingdom. See, Prabhupada's position was continuously getting better. Although his health was getting worse, his power to influence and control was increasing because now he had all these American disciples. The land was overgrown with tall grasses and bushes, and many coconut palms stood throughout. In the back of the property were several tenement buildings. The land bordered on Juhu Road, the main traffic artery, back to Bombay, 18 miles to the south. A broad expanse of beach on the Arabian Sea was a brief walk away. The location was good, peaceful and yet not remote. Several five-star hotels bordered the nearby beach, and developers were beginning to work on other hotels and apartment buildings. When Prabhupada walked along the beach, he liked even more the idea of buying the land. Rich men had weekend homes on the beach, and thousands of Bombayites would be out enjoying the beach on Sundays. So Prabhupada is calculating and analyzing all the different factors. Out enjoying the beach on Sundays. Daily, hundreds of Juhu residents used the long, broad seashore for morning walks before going to work. Almost always people were strolling and gathering there, and yet the beach was clean. The mild waves and open skies were inviting. The locale was ideal not only for hotels, but for a Krishna conscious center. Prabhupada wanted the Juhu land, and though his disciples continued to show him houses in Malabar Hill, he did not change his mind. His disciples wanted whatever he wanted, yet they had trouble developing enthusiasm for a property so far from the city and with no available housing. Mr. N, the owner of the 5-acre plot, had set a reasonable price and seemed friendly and sincere. Yet risks were involved in such transactions. And in this case, Prabhupada even found reasons for suspicion. Through his lawyer, he learned that Mr. N had previously entered into an agreement to sell the same land to the Sea Company, but had later canceled the agreement. The Sea Company had then filed a suit against Mr. N for breach of contract. If the Bombay High Court decided in the Sea Company's favor, the land would be awarded to them. When Prabhupada's secretary questioned Mr. N about this entanglement, N assured him that the Sea Company would not win the suit. But in any case, ISKCON could withhold a certain portion of their payment until the litigation with Sea was settled. N was a well-known figure in Bombay, formerly the sheriff of Bombay. He was now the publisher-editor of one of the largest daily English newspapers in Bombay. He was wealthy, owning several properties in Juhu and Bombay, and influential, not a man one would want to oppose. To purchase the Juhu land under the present circumstances required boldness. In late December, Prabhupada met with Mr. and Mrs. N at their home in the Theosophical Colony in Juhu. Mr. N's home was on the beach, and thus the visit afforded Prabhupada another opportunity to appreciate the value and beauty of Juhu Beach, with its border of palms leaning toward the sea. The Theosophical Colony was a private neighborhood of attractive homes with luxuriant lawns and flower gardens and many exotic birds. Ashok trees grew on either side of Mr. N's driveway. Very soon we'll be hearing about the Ashok Grove, a very famous grove where Sita was incarcerated by Ravana and where Hanuman came and rescued her, found her there. Didn't rescue her, but just informed her that Ram was coming. She was in great lamentation. Mr. N was a short, stocky man with a receding hairline. Srila Prabhupada openly expressed his appreciation of the Juhu land, but admitted he had very little money. Mr. N, however, seemed inclined toward Prabhupada and said he wanted to sell him the property. Quickly, they reached a verbal agreement. Prabhupada and Mr. N agreed on a down payment of 200,000 rupees. Was it really one-to-one in the 70s? $1 to one?
I don't know. In 85, it was 1 to 10.
I mean, it could have been 1 to 1, and that would make 200,000 rupees, $200,000. And that was just the down payment. So, I mean, this is pretty... Prabhupada is pretty amazing that he... In Detroit, we'll read about an amazing thing. He had absolutely no money, and he came and bought a huge building. Because he made Ambarish, Alfred Ford, into a disciple there in Detroit. Pretty amazing. So, Prabhupada and Mr. N agreed on a down payment of 200,000 rupees. After making the down payment, ISKCON immediately received the conveyance. ISKCON would pay the remaining balance of 1,400,000 rupees later in regular installments. Prabhupada negotiated further regarding the down payment, offering to pay 50,000 rupees now and another 50,000 later, at which time ISKCON would be allowed to move on to the land. As soon as they paid the remaining 100,000 rupees, the down payment would be complete and Mr. N would give them the deed. Mr. N agreed. Once committed to the land, Prabhupada began to unfold his vision for a grand project in Bombay. On December 22, he wrote to Yamuna Devi Dasi, "Here in Bombay, we have got good prospects to purchase a very large land in Juhu for a very cheap price, just in the middle of a rich neighborhood. We shall build our camp there and begin constructing a temple immediately, and later on we shall develop a large hotel and school. There's also a chance of getting a nice bungalow in Bombay city also. So in general, we shall make our headquarters in Bombay and we shall also build up Vrindavan and Mayapur." So Prabhupada thought Bombay was extremely important. While devotees around the world were delighted to hear Prabhupada's plan, devotees in Bombay had mixed feelings. To envision a temple rising from what appeared to be a little more than a jungle was not easy. Nor was it easy to envision the 5-star ISKCON hotel Prabhupada spoke of. The tenement buildings in the rear of the land were fully occupied, and according to Indian law, the tenants could not be removed. If the devotees moved onto the land, they would have to erect temporary housing, maybe even a temporary temple, and the land was mosquito-ridden and teeming with rats. Juhu was a small, almost isolated neighborhood without wealthy ISKCON supporters. Although Prabhupada and land speculators predicted that Juhu would grow, at present it was only a village of about 2,000. To reside at Juhu would be a drastic contrast to the comfortable Akash Ganga building in downtown Bombay. Tamal Krishna said to Prabhupada, "We are Westerners, we cannot live like this. We need doorknobs and running water." Prabhupada said, "Don't you want to become purified?" When the Bombay devotees learned of Srila Prabhupada's response to Tamal Krishna, the words, "Don't you want to become purified?" went deep into their hearts. This is very interesting. When the spiritual master calls upon one to do some seva, it actually involves... the whole thing is arranged by Krishna for our purification. Krishna can do anything. I mean, he could liberate the whole universe instantly. So all the things that Prabhupada asks the disciples, at a deeper, more fundamental level, all these engagements are to purify our hearts. So a person who is eager for purification happily embraces the aggressive plans of his spiritual master. Happily volunteers, "Yes, I shall do, Guru Maharaj, I shall do something that you want me to do." And you feel ecstasy and you get purified. Devotees knew that Prabhupada was asking them to become more austere and that it was for their ultimate benefit. They began to regard moving to Juhu as a formidable spiritual challenge rather than a drudgery. See, this is very, all these things are very important that we're learning. We're getting so many messages that we may initially consider a service to be a drudgery. You know what a drudgery is?
I know.
Something you don't want to do. It's very like difficult or boring. Very difficult and kind of boring. And why do we have to do this? Drudgery. But then they switch their attitude. And now it's exciting. It's a spiritual challenge. Like we're adventure. We're having a great adventure. One can view sadhana bhakti as a grand adventure to purify oneself and get the mercy. And if you do, if you have the right attitude, then it becomes very happy. Your process is very happy. Krishna says in the 9th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, susukam kartam avyayam, susukam. Not just sukam, but susukam, Krishna says. That's interesting, how Krishna chooses. Susukam means very happy. Su is an amplifier. Susukam. It's very happily performed, even in the initial stages. Devotional service is happily performed. If you're doing it with the right consciousness. They began to regard moving to Juhu as a formidable spiritual challenge rather than a drudgery. Developing the Juhu property was important to their spiritual master, and it was something greater and more wonderful than they at present realized. They switched into the right consciousness, because a neophyte is constantly being brought by his conditioned mind into the wrong mindset or the wrong consciousness. The mind is always saying, no, it's too difficult. Ah, just enjoy some more sense gratification. This bhakti yoga is too demanding. So actually the real thing in bhakti yoga is not to listen to your mind. Because you're not the mind. This is not an artificial thing. This is actually the truth. This is a beginning stage of self-realization. You're not the body, but you're also not the mind. So you have to realize I'm not this mind. And the way you do it is by ignoring the mind once, hurling yourself into some kind of devotional service, and then you become ecstatic. This mind is actually cheating me. It's the king of cheaters. This mind, which I've given so much trust to, like my best friend, you treat your mind like your greatest advisor, like your topmost genius advisor, because you always follow whatever it says normally. But actually, this is a grand revelation. The one fine morning you wake up. One fine morning you wake up and realize this mind is actually my worst enemy. It's not my best friend, it's my enemy. It's always telling me to do things that will hurt me, make me less happy, instead of things that will make me more happy. It's the craftiest of enemies. The craftiest enemy masquerades as your friend while destroying your program. The dim-witted enemy attacks you from outside, so you can easily recognize and defend yourself against him. That's the foolish enemy. And the very sophisticated enemy makes friends with you and goes along with you while cleverly planning how to ruin you. So that's what the mind is. We fall for it. We've fallen for it 30 trillion times each lifetime. Every time you get in a body, you fall for it again. The mind, whatever kind of nonsense it proposes, you just say, yeah. Because you think you're the mind. This is the fundamental problem, is the conditioned soul thinks he is the mind. We think we're the mind. Whenever it suggests a program, we think, yes, this is what I want. So that's why chanting japa very intensely, it actually creates a distance between you and your mind. You can actually objectively and rationally see that you're not the mind. And that's a very important thing, because then you can chart a course of action that pleases Krishna and your guru, and when the mind, which it always does, tries to interject, you just say, shut up. Like some idiot whispering in your ear, some foolish moron, some drunken homeless bum trying to advise you. You say, shut up. But you can't do that if you don't engage seriously in sadhana. You won't have the clarity and the perception to recognize the distinction between you and your mind. Also, begging for mercy is another good program. If we don't recognize that we're not, then get down on your hands and knees and beg Gaur Nityananda. Nityananda is infinitely merciful, and your spiritual master. Begging and praying is very important, actually, in devotional service. Praying. Because we're not so bright. We're not grand gyanis or austere yogis. We don't really have much qualification, to put it mildly. We have all disqualification for engaging in bhakti yoga. For the process of self-realization in previous ages, there were general qualifications like being austere or being very learned or being very intelligent and sharply discriminated. Unfortunately, we're not so equipped with these assets in the age of Kali. Therefore, the only asset you have is to pray very intensely. Actually, that's the best program, is to pray very hard to Gaur Nitai and your Guru Maharaj. That will work. That will do it. That will make up for the deficit. They began to think of it as a formidable spiritual challenge. Developing the jiva property was important to their spiritual master, and it was something greater and more wonderful than they at present realized. Prabhupada knew he was asking his disciples to make a great sacrifice, but he could not avoid it. To preach Krishna consciousness, a devotee had to be prepared to tolerate many difficulties. And whatever difficulties he was asking his disciples to undertake, Prabhupada was himself prepared to undertake much greater difficulties, because he had a very old body. On the one hand, he did not think that living on the undeveloped jiva property would be too difficult for his disciples, provided they maintained cleanliness and chanted Hare Krishna. Yet he knew that because they were Westerners, they would find it hard. We need doorknobs and running water. Taking birth in the West means that one actually has been addicted to sense gratification for many lifetimes. That's why there are no accidents. The West is the place for people who are shameless sense gratifiers, addicted to sense gratification. But by intelligence, we can understand that we want to give it up. So by intelligence and by prayer. And the less intelligence we have, the more prayer has to be engaged. A preacher, nevertheless, had to make sacrifices, not artificially or arbitrarily, but to expand the Krishna conscious movement. Sometimes serving Krishna was pleasurable, sometimes it was difficult. In either case, the devotee had to do the needful, acting as a menial servant of the spiritual master. Prabhupada counseled his Bombay disciples, impressing on them his vision for ISKCON Bombay. Although all of them were ready to follow his decision, some of them had been feeling doubtful and weak-hearted. Seeing their spiritual master's commitment to the project, however, they vowed to give up their separatist mentalities. Prabhupada then left for Jaipur for a week's preaching engagement at the Radha Govinda temple. It's a very famous temple in Jaipur. So we finished a section now. I guess I can stop now, because we still have to cover moon madness and time travesty. Should we integrate it into a few shlokas from the Bhagavatam, or should we just charge into this subject directly?
I think you should charge into it, because we have about 20 minutes.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry I got carried away.
It was wonderful.
No, it was
by the inspiration of Prabhupada's activities.
Fantastic.
All right, so which should we do first, time travesty or mood madness?
Moon.
Okay, moon. So there's two astronomical systems in the Vedas, and they actually describe the universe in very different ways. This is something very interesting most devotees don't know about. Actually, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur got the title Siddhanta by translating the Surya Siddhanta and Siddhanta Shiromani, which are classical Jyotish Vedanga They're classical Jyotish Shastras. Jyoti means light or astronomy in general. Jyotir Shastra. So he translated from Sanskrit into Bengali, the Surya Siddhanta. Now the interesting thing about Siddhanta Shramani and Surya Siddhanta is they describe the solar system in exactly the way the Western astronomy does. It's quite interesting. Whereas the Bhagavatam, the other astronomical system in the classical Vedic system, describes the universe or the solar system in a vastly different way. It looks totally different. The Bhagavatam describes the solar system as a big plane, actually the whole universe, as a plane, a flat disk of matter called Bhumandala. And it's carved into different ring-shaped islands and oceans. It was actually carved by Priyavrata Maharaj in the fifth canto, as described. These things are, if they test one's credulity or faith. Sariputta told me that many devotees blooped when the fifth canto came out. It was just too much for them. There's the sun god in it with a giant chariot that has one wheel only. The axle is attached to Mount Meru on one side. Imagine a chariot with an axle that's 100 million miles long out to the Lokaloka mountain. It goes from, the Manasatara mountain. It goes from Mount Meru, which is the center of this grand Bhumandala. The central consists of an inverted cone. It's about as far out. If I tried to make it more far, I couldn't. Even in science fiction, it couldn't be. Even if you tried to dream up something more, it couldn't be more far out. If the mountain is made out of gold, solid gold, it's an inverted cone. It's situated in the center, and from it comes an axle that's 100 million miles long. 100 million miles long, all the way out, and there's one wheel. The chariot has one wheel, and it rides on the Manasatara mountain range. So it rides all around. It's a radius of 100 million miles. It goes all the way around. Interesting enough, it correlates closely with 93 million miles, which is the distance from the Earth to the Sun. Some of the features amazingly correlate, but you have to. It's like in a tricky fashion. So, and there's 60,000 sages the size of a thumb offering, looking backwards at the sun and offering prayers to the sun god as he's going around. Because Krishna has a dramatic flair. He likes to do far out things. He likes to put on a wonderful show, amazing arrangement. It doesn't make anything boring. Anyway, that's the fifth canon description. It's all flat, and there are a few planets above the plane, like the moon is above the plane of Bhumandala, and the other planets like Jupiter and Saturn, Venus, Jupiter, Saturn, are above the plane of Bhumandala, going in the up direction, along with Svargaloka. Those planets are part of Svargaloka, actually. Jupiter, Venus, all the way to Saturn. They don't go beyond Saturn, interestingly enough. There's no Uranus or Neptune or Pluto in the Vedic conception. Why that is, that we'll have to do a little research. So the up direction has, above the Martyaloka, the plane of Bhumandala, there's these different planets, then Svargaloka, then there's Janaloka, Tapaloka, Maharloka, and Brahmaloka, or Satyaloka. So that's the vertical dimension. And the horizontal dimension are these ring-shaped islands and oceans, each of which is twice the diameter of the previous one. And it goes out to a radius of 2 billion miles. So the diameter is 4 billion. It's the size of the solar system. It's very close to the size of the solar system, actually. But then you hit the coverings of the universe, so there's nothing outside that. So it looks like the solar system, basically. I mean, in dimension, but it looks very different, that there's a solid disk of matter. So the Surya Siddhanta does not describe the earth like this. That was the Bhagavatam, what I just said. Actually, all the Puranas, there's the Vishnu Purana, there's 18 Puranas. Each Purana has a fifth canto with a description like this of the cosmic geography of Bhumandala. And then, but in the Surya Siddhanta, you have globes isolated globes floating in space, exactly as the Western astronomers say. And the Suryasiddhanta is very amazing. It actually gives the correct diameter of the planets. And that was only known in the West after 1609, when Galileo invented the telescope. Because without a telescope, you can't really see that the planets have a measurable disk. They just look like points of light. In fact, the very word planet, it's a Greek word, it means wanderer. The planets were only distinguished from the stars because the planets move across the sky at a rate you can observe, like over in, if you're sitting in overnight, like a few hours, you'll notice the planets move perceptibly within a few hours, whereas stars take thousands of years to move. They move very slowly across the celestial sphere. So the word planet means wanderer, it's a Greek word. But you can't tell the right diameters, and the Greeks, they made some wild ballpark estimates which were way off, like factor of 10 or 20 off, or 100 off. And the Egyptians, all the ancient cultures, the Sumerians, the Egyptians, everyone except the Vedas, they had wildly wrong diameters for the planets. The Vedic one, Suryasiddhanta, is the only one that has the correct diameters for the planets. But you can't get that without a telescope, but telescopes weren't invented until 1609. So this is actually something very interesting. It indicates Vedic science was way ahead of all other cultures. And Western science is just catching up. Similar thing with quantum mechanics and Prapti Siddhi. Prapti Siddhi means long-range acquisition or instantaneous action across arbitrarily great distance. That's how we can say it. That's what non-locality means, instantaneous action across arbitrarily great distance. So that's, and it took Westerners many thousands of years, quantum mechanics, to get up to that. But in Vedas, that was understood since time immemorial. So actually, Vedic science, there are hints, there are little hints of very advanced knowledge in the Vedas. Even in like Sanatana Goswami's Hari Bhakti Vilas 2.12, he says, as a lowborn, as gold is produced by mixing copper and tin, so a lowborn man can be transformed into a Brahmin by diksha, spiritual initiation. And Sanatana Goswami was just using it as like something insignificant. It's copper plus tin equals gold. And, you know, just it's a mundane example to illustrate how anyone can be turned into a Vaishnava by diksha. But if you analyze this, interesting, Sadhguru analyzed this. If the number of protons in the nucleus of tin is 50, the number of protons in the nucleus of a copper atom is 29, and the number of protons in a gold atom is 79. But no one knew about protons until like Rutherford, 1930s. Mm-hmm. Rutherford. It wasn't until 1930 that they knew about the nucleus as something distinct from the atom, or even there were positively charged things like protons. And Sanatana Goswami wrote this more than 400 years ago. It's impossible, it's physically impossible to know that 400 years ago. So that, another hint, these are little hints, if you read with great scrutinizing detail, that the Vedas have a very high, so high that they don't even care about the material ends. They just sort of offhand, they mention here and there things that are mind-blowing. If some physicists had known about that, you know, in the old, they would have become so famous just using that knowledge. They could have become so famous. Because the Vedas are inviting you to get out of the material, not analyze it in nauseating detail. Whereas the program of chemistry and physics is to analyze the material energy to nauseating detail. Because they're stupid, they think they are the material world. If you think you are the material, then it makes sense to know every little detail about the material energy. But because the Vedic paradigm is completely different, we're non-material beings, we got ourselves into the material because we're dumb, and we should get ourselves out as quickly as possible, so we don't need to know more. Another example of this is the soul being 1/10,000th the tip of a hair. Sometimes students, when they hear that, they say, well, the Vedas are not very sophisticated because hairs obviously have different hairs have different diameters. So it's not a very precise measurement. But what's really going on is that the Vedas don't care about it very much. they don't, it's not a very important thing, the material energy. So they just use like an offhand kind of rough, it's like a ballpark figure. Like if you're asked, like if you say that Dorchester is 10 miles away, well, it's probably only 9.7 miles away, but it doesn't matter. For our purposes, it's okay to say it's 10. That's why you get some things in the Vedas that seem to be imprecise. I'm just sort of filling in a little bit. So Suryasananda describes the solar system the way Western science does, has the diameter of the planets, gives the distance from the Earth to the Moon as 250,000 miles, just exactly what the scientists, everything is the same. It's all exactly the same picture. So Sadaputta, he wrote this book called Vedic Cosmography and Astronomy. It's even on the Veda base that's on our disk, on the disk Veda base. And he tabulated Prabhupada's statements. Prabhupada made various statements about the moon. Sometimes he doubted the honesty of the scientists, like he said it was all faked just to get money from the people. But other times Prabhupada would allow that they actually landed on the moon, or not that, he would never allow that they landed on the moon that what the Vedas call the moon, which is Swarga, it's a Swarga, it's a heavenly planet. There's rivers of nectar. If you read in the fifth, this is another thing that made devotees, like we're reading about Purushottama, remember Prabhupada's servant who couldn't believe. Because there's the things are so far, like in the fifth canto it says there are mangoes the size of elephants, and they fall down and they hit a jagged rock and they crack open, and then mango, there are rivers of mango juice flowing on the moon. Sadaputta told a funny story. When he first joined, he was cleaning the deity kitchen in the back. It was like, I think, the Washington, D.C. temple in the early 70s. And he heard a lecture. Prabhupada was saying, there's rivers of mango juice flowing on the moon. If this is false, all the Vedas are false. So Sadaputta said, wow, we have a lot of work to do. Rivers of mango juice. So the difficulty with the moon trip is many devotees take the position that Prabhupada said they never went to the physical moon that we see. Going to the physical moon, according to the Suryasiddhanta, is not that difficult. It's only 10 times the diameter of the Earth, or the circumference. The circumference of the Earth is 25,000 miles. And the distance from the Earth to the physical rocky globe of moon is 250,000 miles, according to the Suryasiddhanta and Western science. So it's only 10 times longer. And once you get up above a certain point, there's no more gravity, or gravity becomes very weak. It actually falls off as R squared, 1 over inverse distance. But sometimes devotees challenge this. They say, how do we know this is true? So what you can do is, and I did it in the 70s, I was a maniac. I climbed tall mountains like Mount Whitney, tallest mountain in the continental U.S. It's in Northern California. As you climb up, as you go up the mountain, it becomes more difficult to breathe. Well, why is that? Because the gravity is weaker. The oxygen is actually departed. The density of air has gone down noticeably. When you get above 10,000 feet, if you climb mountains, and Mount Whitney is 14,000 feet. To climb Mount Everest, you have to have an oxygen mask. You have to bring oxygen. They can't do it otherwise to get up to Mount Everest, which is 29,000 feet tall. But even, like I got up to the top of Mount Whitney, it's very hard work just to move, to walk and move around. So that supports the Suryasiddhantic and Western science viewpoint that gravity becomes weaker, and the astronauts, if you believe them, maybe they're all cheaters, but I mean, when they were up to a certain orbit in Earth orbit, there was no gravity, they're just floating around, everything was floating. So once you just have to blast off from the Earth and get beyond the gravitational influence, most of course there's always still a little bit. But once you got beyond most of it, you just coast across most of the distance, just a couple thousand miles above the Earth, then basically you can just coast across to the moon, and then you're caught by the moon's gravity. So Sadaputta compiled all the various statements what Prabhupada said about the moon. It's in this book, Vedic Cosmography and Astronomy. But the situation seems to be that it's not very difficult to go to the physical moon, but that's not the real moon. When the moon is talked about in the Bhagavatam, they mean Swargaloka, the heavenly region. And the way Sataputta gives a good analogy is like if you, suppose you say you want to meet someone at the corner of Boylston and Berkeley. So you go there, and you're actually 30 floors up in that tall building, but you're up, you're in a different dimension, you're in a higher dimension. So your friend came there, but he doesn't see you, and then you call down from the window, you know, I'm up here. So in other words, two coordinates, if you only specify Boylston and Berkeley, you've specified not enough coordinates to tell where the person really is at. You need a third coordinate because we're in three-dimensional space. So similarly, in quantum mechanics, they have higher dimensional spaces beyond three. And also in the Vedas, they implicitly higher dimensional space. In other words, you may go to a certain place, like many people go to Badrik Ashram, they make a pilgrimage in India. According to the Srimad Bhagavatam, Vyasadeva is there. And Madhvacharya went there and actually showed his commentary on Bhagavad Gita to Vyasadeva. So Madhvacharya, because he was spiritually qualified, he could see Vyasadeva there in Badrik Ashram. Most pilgrims, they walk right through. They just see snow and ice. They don't see the ashram because it exists in a higher dimensional space. So this is how Sataputta explains the moon situation. If you went to the physical moon now, if we believe the astronauts, maybe they didn't actually go there, that's another matter. But if you went there now, somehow, on the physical rocky globe that the Suryasiddhanta says is only 250,000 miles away, you would not, unless you're spiritually qualified or qualified by punya, by pious deeds, you would not be allowed to see Chandra and his associates, the demigods who are living on the moon. You would just see a rocky place, just like if you go to Badrik Ashram today, you won't see Vyasadeva. Or Kalapagram, in the Bhagavatam, there's a village in the Himalayas called Kalapagram where a representative of the sun god and the moon god are waiting for Kali Yuga. When Kali Yuga is over, they repopulate the earth. That's how Satyuga gets started again, is one of the dynasties of the sun and the moon. They're demigods, they're very advanced people. They're just sitting there, but you can't see them. Like if you're an ordinary person, you go to... In the summertime, when it's not so difficult, you can make a pilgrimage to various parts of the lower parts of the Himalayas. So you could actually go there physically, but you won't see that higher dimensional region that's actually there. So that's how Sataputta explains the moon landing. That it's possible the astronauts could have physically landed on the moon, but they were not allowed to enter into Chandraloka, the heavenly Svargaloka region that is there, because it's higher dimensional. So I will stop now, and if this is not crystal clear, is everything crystal clear?
Crystal clear. Well, how do we reconcile the Bhagavatam picture? Is that the same? Is that how we reconcile it? Is the higher dimension argument?
Yes.
So the...
It's real.
So the inverted cone...
Yes.
Okay.
It's so big, actually, it's much bigger than the Earth, so that inverted cone would block out any, like if you're looking out the window, if it were in our dimensional space, it would block out a big chunk of the sky, a solid gold mountain. It's bigger than the Earth planet. It's huge. I forget the exact dimensions.
Also, one question is, this Bhagavatam is referring to only our specific universe?
I get the impression it's a general model for all universes, but I couldn't prove that. What do you think from your...
Right, same thing. It's a general model for this Bhagavatam's for this universe. And just like other universes have different Brahmas, their Vedas are also much bigger than what we have. So it's not said that this is... Generally, it's for this universe. Also, because the Bhagavatam is a Purana, it specifically deals with personalities in this universe. So it's generally the knowledge of this, of the Bhagavatam, is for this universe. We simply just don't know if there's Bhagavatam. We don't have the Bhagavatam for other universes. It's just not...
One thing we do know from Chaitanya Charitamrita Madhurya chapter 21, when Krishna called the Brahmas with different numbers of heads, you know about that? I won't tell the whole, it's too much. But there, in different universes, there are different numbers, there are different Brahmas with different numbers of heads, because this is the smallest universe. Our Brahma has only four heads because it's the small, Krishna said. He said, you only have four heads because this is the smallest of the universes. So apparently the others are larger. Or
well,
more
I mean,
extensive.
If you say that Krishna likes to, I mean, well, Krishna does like variety, you know, and he likes to put, I mean, I could just see different, like him you know, creating different scenarios
yes.
for other universes.
Maybe, but I don't know. We don't, I dare not speculate.
Right, right. I didn't know if it was said anywhere.
To go into the murky waters of speculation.
So, just to clarify, which one is closer to the Earth? To the Earth, the moon or the sun?
Well, according to the Surya Siddhanta and Western astronomy, the moon is much closer. According to the Bhagavatam, the sun is closer. But here's how Sataputi explains that. I should have mentioned that. That was part of what I was supposed to say. Because you'll read in the Bhagavatam that and Prabhupada will make statements that the sun is closer to the earth than the moon. But here's how Sataputi explains. This is very ingenious. Based on the Surya Siddhanta, which is a bona fide Vedic literature. The moon is further above the plane of Bhumandala, whereas the sun rides on the Manasatara mountain range, which is practically on the plane. So if you're talking about vertical distance, the moon is further away from Bhumandala than the sun. But in terms of linear distance from Jambudvipa, which is the central island where Mount Meru is, then the sun is 100 million miles out, which is roughly correct, I mean, according to Western astronomy, and the moon is actually closer in terms of just linear distance. But if you take, the Earth, now here's another important point I should have mentioned. Earth means Bhumandala, all in the whole Srimad Bhagavatam. Earth is always Bhumandala. It's always, you look. That's the only meaning of the word Earth. They don't use it for any other meaning. So it means the whole plane. So the sun is practically on the plane, whereas the moon is higher above the plane. So when it says there in the fifth canto that the moon is further away from the Earth than the sun, Sataputi explains this as meaning that it's further from the disk of Bhumandala. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And there's that whole book. You have it, I think. You have it. You looked it on your... The Vedic Cosmography and Astronomy. That's what I'm taking. Sadhguru is a master spokesman. He's much better than me. I try to be systematic. But he's very systematic. So it's on the Veda base that comes with the disk. I don't know how to say it. The on-disk Veda base. It's not on the vedabase.net if you look on the on internet. It's not there, but it's on... I have a disk, actually, if someone wants.
That's the one I tried to download and I couldn't.
Yeah, I lent you my disk.
Yeah, I couldn't get it.
Even your newer version of...
What newer version? That's the only version. The only one was the one you had on the disk. I tried to download and I couldn't.
Oh, here's what happened. It was on your old Toshiba satellite. Now you've got a newer one.
Yeah, I didn't put it to my new one. I didn't try it.
Yeah, it'll work on the new one. Your new one. I bet. Then you can read the whole thing. Because I don't think we have a physical copy. I didn't see one anywhere. It was produced... I helped Sataputi make it in the 80s. It came out in 86. And I think it's out of print. So... I hope everyone is... Now, I guess I... By your questions, we covered the moon madness.
Sun and moon, yeah.
Moon madness.
You didn't cover the going back in time part.
Oh, we didn't do the time yet. But we'll surely...
We'll have to do that later.
See, the problem is I have a terminal case of oral diarrhea. So once I get rolling on one subject, I just like to get more deeply into it. But now I think we've covered... Actually, one final point. The materialists will say the Bhagavatam is mythology because it deals with things unverifiable. Whereas we use the concept higher dimensional space, something real but inaccessible to our senses. Real but inaccessible means higher dimensional space. We take it as real. We take the Bhagavatam as real but inaccessible.
And they would just say that's a...
Mythology, that's all.
Yeah, that's just like an argument how to get out of it.
Yeah, that's what... Yeah, convenient...
Convenient.
What's the right... Convenient... what's the right term? You know, when you try to... Anyway, whatever. Yeah, they would say that. So the reason we accept it is for many other reasons, like we're practicing devotional service, we feel ecstasy mm-hmm. by doing what's stated in the Bhagavatam. Also, other hints, like I mentioned the number of protons. There are hints that imply the Bhagavatam really is talking about a higher level of science, but it's something you can't see right now with our present senses. If you don't accept the Bhagavatam, it will be hard for you to advance in devotional service. Because it's connected with Krishna's pastimes. If you take it as mythology, then it will be harder for you to advance in devotional service. And you don't have to do that because there's so many things unknown to science. They're simply outside the range. You can't say yes or no. Maybe it's true, maybe. At least just say maybe, maybe not. You can't. But to say that it's definitely not true, that would be a big mistake. It's for me.
It's for me?
Okay. You're in trouble.
So we now we have to cover. Do we? Is everyone happy with Moon Madness?
Yes. Yeah.
So now we need Time Travesty.
Time.
Let's do time travel next time.
Okay.
Yeah. Is that right?
Yes. Oh yes. I have a terminal case of oral diarrhea.
We love it.
So once I get rolling on one subject, I just get more deeply because there are many facets and analyses.
Yeah.
You're the parent feeding the baby chicks, Prashad. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki.
Yeah. Oh, it's a great time.
Yes.
Everything's okay?
Yes, wonderful. Thank you.
One down, one to go.
Hmm?
One down, one to go.
Subject?
Yeah.
How do you?
That was one question I had, so it's nice that you brought it up. The moon as being further away from the sun.
Yes. I didn't explain it.
That was a question I had. That was one question I had, yeah.
I didn't explain it well, but does everyone understand?
Yeah. No, it makes sense. You explained it perfectly.
Thank you.
Perfectly.
They have a long pole that goes from the mountain to the one wheel.
Yeah, 100 million miles.
Axle.
Axle.
The axle. It's a chariot with one wheel and a long axle.
You're right. Disney couldn't come up with something more crazy than that.
And 60,000 sages with the size of their thumb offering prayers.
60,000 thumb-like sages. I can't forget them.
Thank you. It was great. Fantastic.
Thank you.